Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 63, Zoology, Part 10. Rudolf Steiner gives us a wonderful threefold classification of the animals, that there are those animals which are like an outer manifestation, separate from an organism of the human head. And as I said earlier, in adapting that drawing of Steiner's that was on the title page of the children's main lesson book, we see the bird kingdom especially belongs to that, and the eagle is often used as the overarching symbol of that. The world of the rhythmic system, of the human trunk, as Steiner calls it, that is manifested by the lion, and we can imagine the lion's incredible roar, the power that's coming out of those very, very strong lungs and muscles of the diaphragm to roar in that way. And then the animals which are connected to the human limbs, which have a great deal to do then with the capacity for movement and action. And here we could say that there are predatory animals, the wolf with its remarkable stamina and ability to run at great speed for hour and by hour and hour. But we also see even ruminants can have these limb qualities, like the horse with its remarkable staying power and ability to move at very great speed. So this is very helpful, but please don't feel, even though it may be a tradition in your school or it's what your mentor learned or whatever, don't feel that this threefold quality must be something that is mechanically and slavishly followed. I am certain Rudolf Steiner never meant it in that way. You can have this threefold picture living within you. It can sort of be hovering over everything you're doing. And you need not only deal with three kinds of animals, or six kinds of animals, or nine. It doesn't have to be a multiple of three. And you don't have to be using these concepts and classifications like a bed of Procrustes. You'll learn about that in grade five, in which everything must be stretched or cut off unless it fits. You know, live with these ideas. Find some animals that may be representative, but you may not necessarily be using those animals. Another way of working with the animals, which can be, quite delightful, is using the temperaments as a guide. So, for example, in teaching about those head sensory beings, the birds, although we dwelt on the eagle, and you'll see some illustrations that the children did of eagles, we also looked at other birds as well. And my thought was to try to bring the children really a fourfold experience of the bird world. So for us, the powerful eagle with its aggressive, predacious qualities, with its great weight and its building ability, that became for us a kind of representative of the choleric temperament. Not that I use these words, but just the way I presented it to the children had that coloring. The songbirds, with which they were very familiar in a mid-Atlantic state, the cardinal, the oriole, the blue jay, the chickadee, and so on, with their bright plumage and their joyful appearance and disappearance through different times of the year, these were sort of representative of the sanguine temperament. Some of the water birds, particularly the pelican, were for us emblematic of the phlegmatic temperament. You know, those who kind of hover close to the water, knowing that they can at any time dive down. And like a phlegmatic, you watch the pelicans by the hour just gliding over the water, you know, beating their wings now and then. It looks as though, you know, not a care in the world, completely comfortable, or sitting, floating on the water or on the posts of a dock or something like that. But then when they see fish, the dive that they take, the power, the intensity, my gosh, it is something to behold. And it's very much like that fit of anger that a phlegmatic child may manifest once in those 8 grades, but you watch it when they are there. So the pelicans are a wonderful kind of representation of the phlegmatic temperament. And for melancholia, well, certainly crows might be able to represent that, but we chose the penguins because the penguins go into the darkness and the cold of Antarctica where nothing else goes. There's nothing else alive there, nothing else warm-blooded certainly there. And that's where they choose to go, and that's where they devotedly rest on their eggs, keeping those eggs warm. And then they watch their little ones growing up, proud of their wings, flapping their wings so hard that they're able to be lifted off the snow a little bit. Very exciting. One day, those little ones may be imagining, we're going to fly. We'll be high in the sky like the gulls that we may have seen. But the parents know better. They know that their little ones will never fly, but rather those wings will be used to maneuver them deftly through the depths of the dark sea. So there's a way of sort of presenting these various birds, and you'll see how one group, one temperamental group in the class after another, sort of lightens up and brightens up as they experience that kind of contrast. Another way of doing this, which we also work with, was talking about the beavers. So now we're in the realm of the animals who have incisor teeth, the rodents, whose teeth never stop growing. So lest they get pierced by their own teeth and die, these animals must constantly be gnawing. In the case of mice, of course, it's chewing their way through walls, eating whatever grain or bits of fat they can find. In the case of the beavers, it's working diligently, ceaselessly, on their wonderful beaver dams by cutting down tree upon tree upon tree and building these great constructs on the water, which not only serve them as a home, but also will change the course of streams, change the course of rivers. As we may be learning in geology and or meteorology, it's remarkable how beavers are able to predict floodplains and work in and around them long before a flood occurs. How much responsibility they carry for creating swimming holes in which children can cavort, and also drying up rich beds in which fish were wont to cavort once and now must move on to a completely different place. So we learn about the beavers and their strong family life and the remarkable complexity of the interior of their dams with their very, very protective openings and closings and escape hatches, and how the beaver is able to use its broad, flat tail as a warning device, sending an echo resounding over even the largest lake to warn its family and friends that danger is near. And also then how the beaver is able, when the days grow dark and the snow starts to fly, to now use the wonderful little rooms and chambers that it has created to have a warm and comfortable winter time, in which its body temperature goes way down, its metabolism just about stops, and the beaver and family are able to rest comfortably with one another, coming back in the spring with a good deal of their body weight still intact and ready to go as the sun shines brightly and the water starts to flow again. Now we can contrast this kind of wonderful sort of, we could say, phlegmatic, somewhat sanguine existence of the beaver with the existence of another animal that also carries a kind of nerve sense quality. And this might be the chamois or the mountain goat in North America. So here you have an animal that lives in the heights. Certainly it will find sources of water, such as the mountain streams, melting snow. But basically, its home is where the minerals predominate. And its hooves and the very muscular and yet light composition of its body give it tremendous flexibility and adaptability. Its eyes and its sense of balance give it an uncanny capacity when escaping from a predator or a human hunter, perhaps, to make daredevil leaps across great chasms, knowing that in all likelihood it will land on all four of its feet and be able to move on from great jump to great jump. So here is an animal that is constantly aware of its environment, never staying in one place too long, always glancing around, its sharp eyes seeing things at great distances as well as nearby, looking after its children, teaching them where the grass grows most densely, and places that they should avoid. And then winter comes. The goat and his family have eaten well all summer. They're heavy, and now, as the days grow shorter, a thick coat of fur covers them, assuring them that they will be warm. Yet still, the weather in the mountains is very, very difficult. Storms can come unlike any that had come years before. Heavy rains turning to dangerous ice. Thick, thick snow covering almost all sources of food. And at such a time, the wolves and other predators may grow desperate, may venture higher into the mountains and deeper into the crevices than ever before, and the goat must remain awake and alert. Not for him the easy hibernation of the beaver or the eel. The goat is constantly awake, vigilant, looking after its still growing little ones, protecting its mate. And during a dark and difficult winter in the American Rockies or the Canadian Rockies, many of those goats do not make it through the whole winter. Some are injured, perhaps, breaking a leg, which will mean that they cannot heal and will not be able to go forward, dying of starvation, or perhaps being overcome by a sly and equally hungry predator. By the time spring comes, the goats have shed a good deal of their beautiful winter fur. They are thin. They sometimes almost look bony. Some of them are hobbling around after the long enervating winter, but they start to graze again. Their little ones now are filled with renewed energy. The light of the sun, the gentle winds, and the ever-growing life of the mountains will sustain them through another summer and beyond. So there's another kind of contrast that you can bring to your students. And we might say here, perhaps it's the choleric, melancholic quality that lives so strongly in the mountain goat.